them all.
A foe is hunger and ignorance. Bring them home, bring them home. You can't beat that with bombs and guns. Bring them home, bring them home.
I may be right, I may be wrong. Bring them home.
This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, a speech by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. against the war in Vietnam delivered at the Chicago Labor Peace Assembly in November 1967. But first,
we are now joined by Congressman Major Owens. I commend you and am pleased that you are one of 16 members of the House of Representatives who signed a letter saying, bring the troops home now. Tell us more about the circulation of that letter and what you think its import is.
I think the important thing is that we must not lose the initiative. We need to keep the pressure on in every way possible. And I'm disappointed we got so few signatures, and I wonder what some people are afraid of. More than half of the American people are against the war now. I want to know what my colleagues are so afraid of, but we must not be deterred. A golden opportunity is here, considering that so many people are against the war, and we ought to plan every form of pressure we can keep up until we get to some kind of climactic, maybe spring offensive should be planned, where pressure is put on every elected official at every level, city, state, federal, to speak up and show his constituency that they care about the fact that this war is draining resources that impact across the board on everything we do. Governor's announced these tremendous cuts in health care. He's talked about additional money for education here in New York State, but not nearly enough. All kinds of cuts are coming at the federal level to Pell Grants and work-study programs. Why are we doing this at the same time we're spending almost $2 billion a week in Iraq? We must make that connection and force every elected official into a situation where they have to explain to their people why they are not opposed to the war and put the pressure on Washington through all of these levels of action at the same time.
I did want to ask you, since we have just completed the questioning of Condoleezza Rice and prior to that, Alberto Gonzalez, both of whom we dare say will be confirmed, were you discontent by the rigor in terms of addressing these two critical people in positions that are fundamental to the governance and to, in quote, law and order in this country and in the world community? It would seem to me that there was a rather lukewarm interrogation of people that have positions that are so muscular in their antipathy to positions of peace and justice.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100%. It's a sort of a whitewash by the opposing party, the Democrats. I don't know what they're afraid of. Again, everybody sees the results of the policies that came right out of the Attorney General's office in the White House on Abu Ghraib. You know, they're going to try to focus all that on one lone individual. Well, he's not a nice individual, but to focus all that on one lone individual, and they're going to get away with it unless at every level, when we have an opportunity, we expose what's going on. The members of Congress, certainly the Democrats, had an opportunity to have a more vigorous expose, you know, and force the issue onto the table. They don't get that opportunity much. They won't get it much because we're the minority, and the majority won't even allow expression in terms of calling hearings that are critical of the administration by the minority party. They won't give you a room for it. So all praises to my colleague, Barbara Boxer and I went to Congress together, and I'm so glad that she's leading the way to show that you got to have some guts and stop being afraid of shadows and confront these things head on.
Major Owens, I wanted to return to the issue of the Iraq war and the opposition to it. As Mimi said before, you were one of the 16 Democrats to sign a petition for a withdrawal from Iraq. Did that get covered in the media? I've seen very little media that poses the option, much less advocating with the option of withdrawal. There was something in the Daily News over the weekend about a poll in which two-thirds of the American public want a withdrawal from Iraq, but that doesn't seem to be an option both within the Democratic Party or the mass media.
Well, the great disappointment is that the leadership of the Democratic Party seems paralyzed in terms of offering an alternative. That's the great tragedy of the past election, that we had no strong alternative offered. There are alternatives. I don't know why they can't offer them. What the great fear is. Problem is the oil revenue, and we ought to start with a solution where we say, look, put the oil revenue issue on the table in Iraq, and let's talk about the bulk of the oil revenue going to the Iraqi people. Let's talk about who's going to get what cut for offering technical assistance, for the investments that are made over there already. Call an international conference and have all the major powers around the table. And the first benefit of that would be to let the Iraqi people know we're not going to rip them off on their oil, because that's still in the shadow. There's very little conversation about it. Kerry said very little about it. That's the problem. Any insurgent, it seems to me, could go and sell rebellion to his people by saying, look, they are here to rip us off oil, and they're not talking about what's going to happen to the oil revenue. They're not talking about how rapid they're going to rebuild the country with our own resources. There are a number of ways in which it seems to me you could cut into the power of the insurgency by offering a fair deal guaranteed by all the international partners, and nobody wants to do that because we are there partially to rip them off, and not partially, but that's the primary reason there, to rip them off in terms of the oil revenues.
And what do you say to those members of Congress who say suddenly that they are in opposition to the war, but we are there and we have to continue to rationalize the situation, that the country would be left in, quote, chaos and disarray if there is an immediate pullout of the troops? How do you respond to them? How do you try to bring them on board?
The chaos and the disarray is at a high level already and likely to increase. It's not going away until there is some kind of plan on the table. It says to the Iraqi people, there will be a just resolution of this. The faster we put it on the table and set a deadline for getting out, I know it's considered the most unorthodox thing you can do is dare set a deadline. People will build their own strategies around it. But why not set a deadline? Why not, in addition to saying how are we going to make certain that the Iraqi people get the benefit of the oil revenue that's generated, why not say also we're going to get out by a certain date and begin to do that and have the whole international community as part of that so that people who are in Iraq supporting the insurgency will believe that the international community is behind this, it's going to really happen.
Congressman Owens, in terms of chaos and disillusion, let's turn our attention to the president's budget. Let's talk to his domestic agenda. Let's talk about Social Security. What do you see on the domestic agenda, and how do you see this proposal of the president's on Social Security?
Well, the domestic agenda starts with huge budget cut across the board and everything except the military. And that's the first line of combat. Democrats certainly had better stand up firmly against those budget cuts. Our party will never regain any power and be in the leadership again if we don't stand up against these horrendous cuts that he's going to propose in order to save money to fight the war. In addition to the cuts, he'll be facing Congress demanding more money for the war in Iraq. That probably is going to come even before the cuts are fully articulated. So those are two points where we're going to have a strategy which links the war with the suffering and the kinds of nonsense that's going to go on at every level of government cutting programs that people really need. The Social Security thing is just shows how much of a mandate the Republicans feel they have, or how, even though they know statistically it's not such as great a mandate as they want to make it out to be, how they're going to exploit it. They have a lot of nerve. They dared to give big tax cuts to a small minority of people in the country, and they got away with that. They dared to take us into a war where American lives are being lost. And they've gotten away with so much until now they will take Social Security on, and if we don't rally our own forces, they may end up succeeding with it. The only hope there is that the ordinary people back home in the districts of the Republicans as well as the Democrats will see that this is a program that's the most universal program in the country and the most beneficial one probably in terms of enhanced benefit directed to people, and that they want to defend it and not turn it over to Wall Street and have Bush's friends, his base, as he called it, his base, getting richer and richer off the backs of the poor.
I want to go back to the letter that was signed on January 12th by 16 Democrats in the House of Representatives who sent the letter to President Bush calling on him to begin the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. You expect some consternation or perhaps dismay at the fact that there weren't more people who signed on to this. And actually, there were some names that I had expected to be there that weren't. Perhaps they just weren't available at that moment to sign on. How do you
That's
see?
True. I want to make that correction.
Please.
The fact that some names are not there doesn't mean they weren't willing to sign on. These things are done sometimes. The feeling was that it had to be done rapidly and not wait, and that might have shut out a lot of people because we didn't have a constant set of meetings and ways in which you could make contact with people.
And what of the people like, well, our local representatives? You are exemplary in your antipathy to the war and your belief that the troops must be withdrawn now. We see the Chuck Schumers and the Hillary Clintons who have really given very short shrift to these issues. What's happening? What's the ambiance in Congress that makes for such a timidity and this constant movement to right of center by the Democratic Party? Why is the conclusion necessarily from the loss of the election to move further to the right?
Well,
what is the magic answer there?
The question of the day.
How much time do you have? I have to write a treatise on that one. The more practical question is, what percentage of people in New York State now are against the war? If 2/3 of the American people are against it, according to Daily News, then an even greater percentage probably in New York State who are against it. How do we get that expression out there so that every elected official, senators as well as representatives, will have to respond to it? I think that the election coming up with Senator Clinton, just had one with Senator Schumer. He had no real opposition, and his positions are pretty well known. But the positions that he could defend one way a year ago, I don't think are defensible now in terms of what's happening with the war and where people's heads are. So it's a matter of New York State has to be mobilized, galvanized to make certain that the will of the people is reflected in the policies that all elected officials carry out.
What plans do you have in terms of your particular agenda in the House during the next period of time? Obviously, the war is one specific issue, Social Security. Are there other things that are specific to your considerations?
Well, my first consideration is to work hard to keep the Democratic Party from going into the tank. These kinds of philosophies that you indicated before, people thinking that you got to go and get a Southerner or a Midwesterner, and that we lost because we weren't conservative enough. Some people are really, I'm afraid, stupid enough to really believe that religion is an issue in terms of we got to show that Democrats are religious like the Republicans. The Republicans are not religious. The leadership is not religious. They're the most cynical and amoral people you want to find, but they know how to manipulate religion. That's the issue that we have to face up to. I'm afraid our party does not have enough respect for ideas, enough respect for strategies, and they don't really understand what now some writers have made obvious. I think there was an article in one of the magazines which went through great detail about how think tanks that were developed by the Republicans are constantly feeding them ideas and how there's enough respect among the Republican politicians, including the guy who masterminded Bush's campaign, enough respect for ideas to take them and manipulate them in ways in which they are effective. Democrats seem to have come to the conclusion too early that all it was about was money. If we can beat the Republicans raising money, then we can win. And we didn't beat them raising money. We never will. But we raised enough money. There is a point of diminishing return in terms of the amount of money. Kerry ended up having a great surplus. So money was not the issue. Ideas and maneuvering was the issue. We blew it at the Democratic Convention. I was there in Boston, and I saw overconfidence. I saw no sense of trying to discern what our opposition was going to do. You know, in terms of we know we had the advantage in terms of the war that was being lost. We had advantage in terms of the taxes being going to the rich and other folks not getting them. Why didn't we figure out a bit more time on what are they going to do to try to combat this? How are they going to combat this? And the religion issue was not such a mystery. Why didn't we figure out some strategy to keep them from distorting the whole situation with respect to religion? The party needs to understand it's up against a political war machine unlike anything that's ever been created in the history of the world. It's Machiavelli mechanized, computerized, and Machiavelli with a whole chorus of geniuses out there in those think tanks. President Heritage House was on the C-SPAN this morning. And out those think tanks are people who are brilliant, and the political leadership of the Republican Party appreciates that in terms of what can we take and distort and manipulate and overwhelm Democrats with. And we have to come back as Democrats and appreciate ideas as well as money.
Well, Congressman Owens, thank you for your insights, and most importantly, thank you for signing on to the letter and mobilizing against this horrible occupation and its license in some ways for incursions, invasions in yet other areas of the region as well. And I certainly would reference an article by Seymour Hersh on our activities in Iran, and you can certainly find that on the internet. Well, we are just about concluded. 30 seconds for your final congressman's comment.
Prepare right now for a major peace offensive in the spring. We should see ourselves in terms of trying to reach some kind of point where we can push policy so that Washington cannot turn its back on the people. You know, with two-thirds of the people, or even half the people, being against the war at this point, between now and April or May, many more will be there. It's a matter of how are we going to mobilize those people, how are we going to make an impact, and let our elected officials know you just can't sit there and be afraid of your shadow. You have to take some actions to deal with this monstrous war.
Congressman Major Owens, thank you very much for joining us.
Back in 1965, when I first wrote this song, it was "If You Love Your Uncle Sam, Support Our Boys in Vietnam, Bring Them Home."
Now, a speech by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. against the war in Vietnam, delivered at the Chicago Labor Peace Assembly in November 1967. Dr. King emphasizes the effect of the war on the psychology of the nation and on the domestic agenda, especially the war on poverty.
My brothers and sisters of the labor movement, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to be some little part of this extremely significant assembly. I don't feel that I come among strangers today, for I feel that I'm an honorary member of many labor unions all across the country. But in all seriousness, I'm delighted to be here, and I want to get right into the message, and I want to try to talk very honestly and frankly about this great problem, this great issue that we face as a result of the war in Vietnam. Some of my words may appear to be rather harsh, but they will be as harsh as truth and as gentle as a nonviolent devotee would be. And I want to use as a subject the domestic impact of the war in America. And this question is historic because it is an authentic expression of the conscience of the labor movement. As has been said already this afternoon, tens of millions of Americans oppose a war in Vietnam. Never in our history has there been such a passionate popular resistance to a current war. In addition to the millions upon millions of ordinary people, eminent scholars, distinguished senators, journalists, businessmen, professionals, students, and political leaders at all levels have protested the war and offered alternatives with an amazing tenacity and boldness. But one voice was missing, the loud, clear voice of labor. The absence of that one voice was all the more tragic because it may be the decisive one for tipping the balance toward peace. Labor has been missing. For too long, the moral appeal has been flickering, not shining as it did in its dynamic days of growth. This conference, a united expression of varied branches of labor, reaffirms that the trade union movement is part of forward-looking America. That no matter what the formal resolutions of higher bodies may be, the troubled conscience of the working people cannot be stilled. This conference speaks for millions. And you here today will long be remembered as those who had the courage to speak out and the wisdom to be right. It is noteworthy that the Labour Party of Great Britain, which of course has no responsibility for our actions, nonetheless went on record on October 4th in a formal national resolution calling upon its Labour government to dissociate itself completely from U.S. policy in Vietnam. It urged its government to persuade the United States to end the bombing of North Vietnam immediately, permanently, and unconditionally. Now, what are some of the domestic consequences of the war in Vietnam? It has made the Great Society a myth and replaced it with the troubled and confused society. The war has strengthened domestic reaction. It has given the extreme right, the anti-labor, anti-Negro, and anti-humanistic forces a weapon of spurious patriotism to galvanize its supporters into reaching for power right up to the White House. It hopes to use national frustration to take control and restore the America of social insecurity and power for the privileged. When a Hollywood performer, lacking distinction even as an actor, can become a leading war hawk candidate for the presidency, only the irrationalities induced by a war psychosis can explain such a melancholy turn of events. The war in Vietnam has produced a shameful order of priorities in which the decay, squalor, and pollution of the cities are neglected, and even though 70% of our population now live in them, the war has smothered and nearly extinguished the beginnings of progress toward racial justice. The war has created the bizarre spectacle of armed forces of the United States fighting in ghetto streets in America while they are fighting in jungles in Asia. The war has so increased Negro frustration and despair that urban outbreaks are now an ugly feature of the American scene. How can the administration, with quivering anger, denounce the violence of ghetto Negroes when it has given an example of violence in Asia that shocks the world? The users of naval guns, millions of tons of bombs, and revolting napalm cannot speak to Negroes about violence. Only those who are fighting for peace have the moral authority to lecture on nonviolence. Now, I do not want to be misunderstood. I am not equating the so-called Negro violence with the war. The acts of Negroes are infinitely less dangerous and immoral than the deliberate acts of escalation of the war in Vietnam. In fact, the Negroes in the ghetto, goaded and angered by discrimination and neglect, have for the most part deliberately avoided harming persons. They have destroyed property, but even in the grip of raids, the vast majority have vented their anger on inanimate things, not people. When I first decided to take a firm stand against the war in Vietnam, I was subjected to the most bitter criticism by the press, by individuals, and even by some fellow civil rights leaders. There were those who said that I should stay in my place, that I was a civil rights leader, and that these two issues did not mix, and I should stick with civil rights. Well, I had only one answer for that, and it was simply the fact that I have struggled too long and too hard now to get rid of segregation in public accommodations to end up at this point in my life segregating my moral concern. And I made it very clear that I recognize that justice was indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And then there were those who said, you're hurting the civil rights movement, and one spoke to me one day and said, now, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy? I understand that your position on Vietnam has hurt the budget of your organization, and many people who respected you in civil rights have lost that respect, and don't you think that you are going to have to agree more with the administration's policy to regain this? And I had to answer by looking that person into the eye and say, I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a sucher for consensus, but a molder of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must take it because conscience tells him it is right.
You've been listening to a speech by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. against the war in Vietnam.
Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. I may be right. I may.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.